Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining this medcast entitled Empowering Patients, Defining Moderate Plaque Psoriasis, and the Promise of Novel Oral Systemic Treatments. I'm Lauren Miller. I'm a dermatology PA practicing in Oxford, Alabama at Southern Skies Dermatology and Surgery. And I'm joined today by, I feel like my sister from another mister is what I say, because we've done several of these together, Jamie.
Yes, we
So I kind of feel like we should be like we're related now. So Jamie, introduce yourself and tell everybody where you're from and how long you've been doing dermatology.
I'm Jamie Heim, and I'm a nurse practitioner at West Michigan Dermatology. And I've been doing this for a couple decades now, and I really love it. I'm very passionate about it, and I'm very fortunate to work in dermatology.
Well, I'm fortunate that you work in dermatology too, because I've learned a lot from you over the years. So,
Thank you.
in today's program, we're going to discuss some exciting new developments in the treatment landscape for plaque psoriasis. It's been kind of a little boom of options over the last really decade, but even the last 1 to 2 years, we've had numerous new therapies come to market, which has been wonderful news for our patients, especially when they have a really sometimes often challenging journey trying to find a therapy that works for them. So, having these new treatment options can really kind of help alleviate the disease burden of plaque psoriasis. So, we're going to have a really good, robust discussion today. And to join Jamie and I, we have Lakshi Aldridge. Hi, Lakshi. It's good to see you. Well, let's kick it off and let's get started. I want to start with something that is near and dear to my heart and something that I feel very passionate about. It's no secret that I love inflammatory skin diseases. And part of that is kind of diving just a little bit deeper than the skin. And I think early on in my career, before I really knew any different and really knew about comorbidities and things like that, what I worried about was getting patients clear skin. And now we know that that isn't just enough. Gone are the days of just trying to fix their skin. So we know that there are many comorbidities that come along with all of the inflammatory skin diseases, really, but specifically plaque psoriasis. And one of those is the psychosocial impact these patients experience because of their disease. And this can include depression, it can include anxiety. And so, this is something that I really try to make sure that I really probe my patients about, because they don't often tell you things unless you ask. And so, I want to talk about that a little bit. And I was really interested to see, Jamie and Lakshi, how does this kind of play out in your clinical practice? Do you have patients that will actively tell you that they're experiencing some psychosocial impacts? Or do you find that you often have to kind of probe and ask them that question to get them to talk to you about it? So, Lakshi, let's start with you.
It's such a great question, and I think it's one that we really didn't even think about. Initially, when I started in the world of dermatology 20 plus years ago, along with Jamie, we were really looking at psoriasis as solely being a skin condition. Didn't even really understand the comorbidities internally, the inflammatory nature of this affecting every single organ of the body. When we would talk about psychosocial issues, we really looked at it from the perspective of course, you're going to be depressed. Of course, you're going to have anxiety. You have psoriasis, which is a very visible disease. You're wearing it on your skin for the whole world to see. Natural for you to have depression and anxiety. One of the most profound things that I realized in my learning and understanding of the pathogenesis of psoriasis is really how TH17 mediated inflammation affects, as I said, every organ, including the brain. So the changes that we see, the inflammation that we see occurring in the skin, in the heart, in the liver, it's also occurring in the brain. And so the depression and anxiety, of course, may be influenced by the psychosocial impact of it being visible and having the embarrassment of being seen with this condition, but there's actually pathology that's happening in the brain that contributes to the severity and the chronicity of depression and anxiety. And therefore, when we reduce that inflammatory burden, not only are we clearing the skin, we're also clearing the inflammation in those other organs, including the brain, resulting in improvement of that depression and anxiety. People come in and they say, "Oh my gosh, I feel so happy. I feel so much better. I feel more confident." And we attributed that to, well, of course, your skin is clearing, you should feel better. Not really understanding that that's also improvement of the inflammation that's going on in the brain. So I think it's really, really important. It's also empowering to the patients to hear that, because oftentimes I had one patient tell me, "Oh my gosh, thank you, Lakshi, for telling me that. I used to feel like such a failure and I used to feel so weak. I would just tell myself, why can't I get out of this depression? Why can't I get out of this slump?" And I would just beat myself up about it every day. And hearing that it's not my fault, it's not something that I just can't pull myself out of. There's something actually going on, just like high blood pressure. This is something that's happening in my brain. And with these medicines, I can get better. And that was really liberating. That was a lesson I learned.
Yes. Yeah, numerous studies have really linked inflammatory diseases with psychological stress. They see similar cytokines, inflammatory cytokines in depression as they do in plaque psoriasis. So now we know, just like you said, that yes, they may have been depressed some or had anxiety because of the way they looked, but it's not just because of that. It's actually can be independent of what they look like, and the severity of the disease doesn't necessarily mean how severe their psychosocial impact may be. So, Jamie, do you have patients that will just openly kind of talk to you about that, or do you find that you have to kind of probe them to get them to talk to you about how they're feeling?
It depends. There are some patients that are very open about it. Usually, the patients that are very frustrated, and they've been to two or three dermatology providers, and they've really not had anything more than a 30-gram tube of clobetasol. They're really frustrated. This is one story that is very impactful, and I have never forgotten it. I had my MA went into the room. My MA came out and just looked at me, and he said, I don't want to tell you. And I said, what do you mean? I said, you don't know what to tell me. He said, I don't know what to tell you. So I walked into this room. This gentleman was sitting there and he looked at me and he said, I have driven an hour and a half to see you. I have seen three different providers already in dermatology. And if you can't fix what's going on with me, it's it for me. I'm checking out. And what he meant is he was going to commit suicide. And so, literally, this guy had just had it, completely had it. And I said to him, and I said, well, I said, that won't be necessary because I can help you. And, so, it really, and it was really, he was just so fed up, so fed up. Also, I had another patient, and he came in a year later, and I had seen him during that process too. And it was his birthday. And he said, I want to thank you. And I said, why? He said, because I'm a year older today because of you. So it's these types of things, that sometimes patients don't tell us, and other times they tell us that, they are living with this heavy burden of disease and they're very tearful. And you walk into the room and they're just telling you about how this impacts their life and how, and you're literally just handing the Kleenex and, and listening to them. And so some people, they're more open about it, other people aren't. But I find too, also when I do a lot of precepting for the universities. And I find that when I have a student with me, and those patients will say to the students, they'll tell them how impactful it is, how much it affected their life, their quality of life, how they did not want to do certain things, how they didn't want to have social interactions in the act, and how isolated they felt. And that's really important.
Jamie, I agree with you, everything that you said. And I find that when you go the extra mile and ask the question, whether it just be, how are you feeling today? How is this disease affecting you? Is it affecting you at all? They feel like you actually care and you're committed. And I can't tell you how many times I've had a patient that even said, "You're the first person that's actually even put hands on me, much less asked me how I was feeling." And so that always breaks my heart when I hear that. But experiencing postpartum depression myself with both of my boys, it's something that I share openly. And so, the psychosocial impact, with depression and anxiety is just near and dear to me. And so when these patients come in, my heart just breaks for them. And so I find it very, very important, but also very liberating for them to have somebody just inquire and just ask them. So something that Lakshi said earlier, mentioning that patients, feel liberated because you're telling them and showing them that it's not their fault, that there is a reason why they feel this way. And it's not just because of the way their skin looks, but because there's something going on inside their body. And just taking that extra time to explain that to them and just ask them the question, I know just means so much to them. So let's talk a little bit. This is something that we have really gotten into with the previous sessions that we've talked about, but it's something that I kind of feel like is important because I think this is where we tend to have a little bit of a disconnect and where I find that we end up undertreating our patients. And that is the discussion around moderate plaque psoriasis. I think we all know what mild is and what it looks like. I think we can kind of pick out a severe, but it's that moderate patient that seems to be somewhere in the middle where we have some providers that still just don't quite know, okay, are they severe enough for me to consider them for a systemic or a biologic? Or I think they might still need to just do topical therapy. And so, Lakshi, I've asked every single guest that we've had, how do they define moderate disease? Do you go by the guidelines? Do you take into account, body surface area? Do you take into account, how it's affecting the patient's lives? Talk to us a little bit about how you manage and address moderate disease.
That is such a great question. And I think it's one that's super important for our patients because oftentimes they've never really thought about it. Now, we have gone through an evolution of how we grade the severity of psoriasis. I wrote an article about this, and this was back in the day when we really looked at the National Psoriasis Foundation guidelines, BSA 0 to 3%, 4 to 9%, and then anything over 10% was considered severe. And now we know, there's a lot of different things to take into consideration: location, impact on quality of life, itch associated with it, burning associated with it. So you can have, a very small area, for example, involving just the elbows, that some people would never think it really bothers them. It doesn't itch, it doesn't burn, they don't care about it. And then there are some people who might have a small area in the scalp or in the genitals, which can be extremely frustrating. And then you have patients where you have both of their legs completely covered, and it can, when we look at it, that's clearly over 10% body surface area, but it's hardly bothersome to the patient because they always wear pants. They don't think about it. But one of the things that I learned that was super interesting from a colleague was that they really don't even look at BSA anymore. What they really look at is from the perspective of treatment and the impact on quality of life for the patient. And what they look like is the what they look at is the patient's involvement. And they think about, is this a patient, someone who can be treated appropriately with a topical? And if not, then it's systemic. So there's no conversation even about moderate or severe. It really is this a patient candidate who can be controlled with topicals, or is this a patient who requires systemic therapy? There isn't even that discussion anymore about going from topicals to orals and then to biologics. It's really a category of topicals versus systemic treatment. And when we talk about moderate disease, it falls kind of sometimes right in the middle there. So it's nice to be able to think about it that way, that, if they have just a little bit of scalp involvement where they can use a little topical treatment, great, that's wonderful. But if they've got a spot here, something on their elbows, a little bit more on their legs, and you think about topicals sometimes once a day or even twice a day, every day, that can just be really tedious. You're thinking more about moderate or severe disease. doesn't quite match the severity angle, but it's definitely in that category, not quite mild, certainly more than what you would want to manage with just a topical every day. So then it falls into that category of systemic treatment. So then when you think about systemic treatment, you do have that robust conversation, pros and cons of all of the different treatment options, including orals versus biologic therapy. So again, to go back to your question, how do I gauge moderate psoriasis? I really don't. What I really think about is, can this patient's quality of life, their symptoms, and their disease be treated with a topical treatment in a reasonable way, or is that going to be too much of a time constraint on them? And is this patient really a candidate for systemic treatment?
Yeah, that's a great approach. I really like how you explained that. Because when I first started, that essentially the way I was taught was you go from topicals, and if it's not effective, then you go to your orals. And if that's not effective, then you go to your biologics. And so I've known over time that we're not really doing it in a linear fashion like that anymore. But I do still find that we have some colleagues that still look for that mild or moderate or severe kind of diagnosis to help them decide what kind of therapy that they're going to put their patient on. So I love that. So it's almost like instead of three buckets, we now have two. So it's, can we manage them with topicals? If not, okay, we're systemics, biologics. So that is a great approach. Jamie, and I've heard you kind of say something similar. Do you want to add anything to that?
I think that too, just kind of rule of thumb kind of things. When we look at BSA, I think it's easy that everybody can learn about BSA and clarify that by just looking at the Palmer method, which I think is nice. I really like to look at PGA. I like to look at the mild, moderate, and severe based on the erythema that's there, because that erythema tells me about the activity within that seriatic plaque. The other thing, the induration, the thickness of that plaque, as well as the scaling that's there, and especially looking at those impactful areas. So if you have somebody that has palmar plantar psoriasis, you're not going to see a lot of that erythema, but you're going to see a lot of plaque and mostly a lot of induration and causing those severe fissuring, which leads to pain, and also the problem where they can't effectively use their hands, or they have so much discomfort while walking on with their feet. Also, too, lots of times patients that work on their knees or have jobs that they're mechanically working more with on their elbows or their knees, such as doing insulation, things like that, carpeting insulators, things like that. Those patients too, I mean, that is functional for them. And when they have really active plaques, I've had a gentleman who said to me, I can't operate my crane anymore because I have to sit on my butt to operate my crane. And the plaques on his by his gluteal cleft and on his buttocks were so thick, and he'd sit down and he would just fissuring and bleeding when he did so during the day. And then it would get hot because in his crane, it wasn't air conditioned and the sweat was rolling down into these open areas. So I think that, when we're talking, about that, looking also just at, the not only the functionality, the quality of life, but looking at the erythema, the induration, and the scaling itself within an area. The thicker the induration is, the more scaling you have, the more fissuring you have, and it just feels like it's encased. So, and you have no pliability to the skin. So I think that that's another important factor.
Yeah, it's almost like we have a formal definition, but then we kind of have more of a clinical definition. It's like you've got
Yes.
your textbook, but we don't always go by textbook. It's almost like using a med off label. We know what it's supposed to be for, but we're going to use it for something else. It's not always cut and dry like that. So, all righty. So, talking about, just moderate disease, oh, wait, nope, we've already did this.
Yeah, you can move
Sorry,
on to
y'all.
the next question, Laura.
Yeah,
Like you
sorry.
covered it. Yeah, no worries. No,
Yep, we covered
you all
number
covered it.
three.
Yep.
Okay.
You know, Lauren, right there, just in regards to that, it might help to even just talk about when you're, getting access to medications for patients, what's really important to put in your documentation. And that might be because even though, like Lachi says, looking at, like a 3% or a 5%, it's important for the insurance companies and documentation. And so that
Good
might be
thought.
helpful.
Yeah, I like that. Okay. Let's see. I'm gonna start over with the part that I talked about, kind of like a formal definition or whatnot. So it's almost like we have a formal definition of mild, moderate, or severe, and then we have what we kind of use clinically. And so because of that, it's important to include some information in your charts because, like you both said, they may not have the formal definition of moderate disease. Maybe they don't have, 3 to 10% BSA, but it is affecting their quality of life. It is affecting their sleep. They do have chronic itch. Maybe they can't, it's a mom and she can't take care of her baby, whatever it might be. You want to document everything that you can in that chart so that when you need to go to bat for the patient to get them that systemic therapy, it's going to be a whole lot easier to get that approved. Do you guys have any other pearls other than just documentation in the chart? Anything specific that you guys include that maybe we might not think about? Lachi.
I think it's a really great point, and I always do document something in the chart. BSA is the classic one, and it's one that's really easy. Again, a bold handprint, and it's easy to gauge that. Quick, easy measure to put in your chart. And then that way you can see and gauge how patients are improving over time. So I love the BSA. Jamie mentioned the PGA or the IGA, which is a really nice, easy measure as well. A scale of 0 to 4, and something that's easily documented as well, but taking into consideration more of the erythema scaling and duration. I also really love using a measure such as a DLQI, which assesses their quality of life. Of course, that takes time and it requires the patient to complete that, but these are also patient-reported kind of tools that can be easily utilized that talk about that and can be a gauge that insurance companies can use, providers can use to justify requiring some of the more costly systemic treatments that we use. So fortunately, we have some excellent tools that are objective measures that we can use in our documentation.
Yep, those patient-reported outcome measures. I know a lot of companies are putting those in their pivotal trials now, and it's becoming something that we really do look to in order to be able to decide whether or not a medication is effective or not. Yes, does it clear the skin? We want to know that, but we want to know these patient-reported outcomes. How does the patient feel about the drug? So I agree. I like that idea of including that. Jamie, anything different?
The only other things that I always add is the pruritus scale. So if they're having problems with itching in that for certain areas, because I've had patients too that have plaques that itch so terribly that they've had secondary infections. And that's another, that's another comorbidity really. And the other thing is that pain. I mentioned the gentleman who's a crane operator, and it's extremely painful. We have a pain scale that we can use. Utilize 4 to 10, 5 out of 10. And that's something just easy to do, just writing pain, colon, 4 out of 10. And that's something that's very easy to go ahead and evaluate.
So we've talked about how we might go about choosing the right therapy for a patient based on whether or not they're mild, moderate, or severe. So based on severity, but we might also use their comorbidities that they have. We might take into account, patient preference. Do they want to do something oral? Do they want to do an injection? But we also then always take into account safety. And the safety part can be an issue, especially when we have some of these new novel options that aren't as well understood. And so what ends up happening, I think more than what we realize, is that we're under treating patients because we might be a little bit scared of some of the safety nuances with some of these new novel treatments. So let's talk a little bit about how you, Lakshi, kind of balance that risk of undertreatment. Do you find that you even think about that? Because obviously, if we're undertreating, then the patient's not going to get the clinical response and improvement that we want them to have. They're definitely not going to be satisfied with the treatment that they have. So talk to me a little bit about that. And if that's something that ever kind of comes into your mind when you're treating patients, obviously, you've been doing this for a really long time, and I'm sure you feel very well versed and comfortable with these options. So maybe it's not necessarily something that you think about in your clinical practice, but I know you do speak to a lot of other providers and students. How would you discuss this with them?
So, I think I use a very simple example that is quite impactful. And that is, how would we sort of gauge the quality of a cardiologist who left a patient with a blood pressure of 180 over 98? And didn't treat it, okay? We don't often see that because we don't see people wearing their blood pressure out on their skin. But when I see a patient who has come to me from another dermatology practice and they say, oh yeah, I've been treated with this for so long, it doesn't seem to be working or it's at bay, and they have quite a bit of psoriasis on their skin, I internally cringe because I know that one of my colleagues, one of my partners in the dermatology field has really done this patient a disservice. I don't think it's any different than having uncontrolled blood pressure, which can lead to a heart attack or a stroke. We know that psoriasis, again, much more than skin deep, and we know that untreated psoriasis can lead to heart attack and stroke. It can lead to inflammation in every single one of those organs. So when I explain it to that patient, I tell them, what you see on your skin is like the coals on a fire. There's a fire still going on that we don't want to have inside of you, and we need to dampen it. Unfortunately, right now, we don't have a cure for psoriasis. We can't put it out completely, but we can tamp it down so that we are not seeing the smoke, we are not seeing the redness, and we are not having the inflammation in those other organs. So I really liken it to, it should not be viewed any differently or any less severe than hypertension or diabetes. We have goals. We have a high blood pressure. Blood pressure needs to be 120 over 80. We want a hemoglobin A1C that's less than 6. In psoriasis, we want body surface area that is clear or near clear. So we should hold ourselves to the same standards that we hold cardiologists, endocrinologists, and other providers who have specialty practices.
And I think maybe because in the past we didn't have the options that would get us clear, almost clear. And so with that not even being something that even ever crossed our mind as being able to give to our patients, that can be where some of the undertreatment came because we didn't have the options to. But now we do have more options. So Jamie, what are some of maybe the new novel options that you've utilized? And just how do you view anytime something new comes to market and how you kind of start to incorporate that into your practice and in hopes of helping to prevent undertreatment?
I think for one, that there's not a cookie cutter approach. And I want everybody to know that there's not a cookie cutter approach. Each of our patients are individuals. They are all different from one another. So even like when we have these classifications of medications, we are so fortunate. And, looking back at all the years and watching as everything has evolved over all the years, this is amazing. There is not one medication that is for every person. We've seen that. We've needed this. We also look forward to continual research and development when it comes to those patients with psoriasis. We have advanced tremendously And we cannot continue to advance, and we cannot continue to do the best for our patients unless we continue to educate ourselves and immerse ourselves in our patient's journey. And so, and I really mean that, we need to educate ourselves. We can't be afraid to treat our patients. We need to go ahead and learn everything. We need to look at the clinical data. We need to look at the mechanism of action. We need to look at if it's appropriate for that patient or not appropriate for that patient. You can't just learn one medication and prescribe it for everybody. And if it doesn't work, say, well, I don't know what to do. Just keep using it and I'll just add a topical to it. That's not appropriate. So we need to do that. We have, even within the last couple years, we not only have new topicals, we have an aerohydrocarbon for psoriasis, we have a PDE4 inhibitor for psoriasis, we have dacarbazine, which is an oral medication, which is a TYK2 for psoriasis. These are new medications. You think about those topicals. We've had topicals forever, and we've had steroids since the 1950s. And we need to look at new things for our patients, too. We need to look and educate ourselves. We need to educate our patients, and we need to move forward. I just hate the fact that sometimes, you know, people get stuck. There's no reason to get stuck. We need all the tools in our arsenal to be able to treat our patients. This is a chronic disease. It lasts them most of their lifetime, if not their whole entire lifetime. And if we are actually going to combat their comorbidities, including psoriatic arthritis, we need to go ahead and make sure that we're constantly evolving and we're constantly educating, just like the development of these new medications that we have.
I definitely think that having these novel therapies and just new options obviously is never a bad thing, because like you said, there's not one drug for every patient. So the more options that we have, the better chance we have of being able to offer our patients that clear, almost clear skin. So, but I do agree with you when we talked about continuing that education and continuing that learning, because you do need to understand the pathogenesis of the disease and the pathophysiology. You do need to understand the mechanism of action, because if you don't, you're not going to understand then why we see this, maybe the safety signals that we see with those. And so I think it's, you know, I think in a bit years ago when I first started, you know, we only had a couple options anyways. And I really feel like this, the science, we hadn't really grasped all of the science yet. And so it wasn't as big of a deal if you didn't quite understand every little nuance of the mechanism of action or something like that. But I kind of feel like those days are gone. You really, with these new drugs, you know, we didn't talk about the JAK-STAT pathway, you know, even 5 years ago. And so, but if you don't understand those things, it's going to be really difficult for you to be able to prescribe those medications and do your patients justice. One, you feel comfortable prescribing them. But then two, know what to do if something happens, or if you do have an adverse event, or knowing whether or not, like you said, knowing which ones you can use in which patients. So you mentioned deucravacitinib. We know they have obviously their pivotal trials, and it's been out now for, I want to say, maybe close to 2 years now. They're fixing to launch their 4-year safety data, which I'm excited to see. But let's talk a little bit about the novelty of deucravacitinib. Lakshi, I'm going to let you talk on this. And if you have some experience with this new product, it's not quite so new yet, but it is in the grand scheme of things. And, you know, how have you found that you've used this with your patients? And have you seen an impact on quality of life with this new novel therapy and mechanism of action?
So deucravacitinib has really revolutionized the way that we are looking at the management of psoriasis, specifically because it was one of the first JAK inhibitors that we have been able to utilize in the dermatology spectrum. Now we know that JAK inhibitors are being used for a lot of dermatologic conditions, including alopecia and vitiligo. But deucravacitinib really opened the door for dermatology providers to think about a novel mechanism of action for the treatment of such chronic conditions such as psoriasis. So the novel action of JAK inhibitors was kind of met with skepticism and a little bit of fear from the dermatology community, just because our experience had really been looking at the use of JAK inhibitors in the rheumatologic conditions. And in that population of patients, it was met with some significant side effects that were really quite concerning for us as dermatology providers. But what deucravacitinib did was it really kind of turned the page for the novel action of JAK inhibitors, specifically because this wasn't a JAK pathway that is typically seen in rheumatology. It's actually deucravacitinib is a TYK2 pathway, which is something that's novel. So TYK2 inhibition has proven in the clinical trials with deucravacitinib to be incredibly safe and highly effective. This is something we did not expect to see in the clinical studies, efficacy and safety with an oral agent that was very comparable to some of the early biologics, specifically the TNF-alpha inhibitors. More specifically, the safety profile of this drug as an oral treatment that was intracellular action versus biologic therapy, which the action happens outside of the cell. This is intracellular inhibition. We really expected to see more side effects. And in fact, we saw that in the rheumatologic space with JAK1 and 2 pathways. But with the TYK2 inhibition, we really didn't see that side effect profile that was concerning, specifically deep vein thrombosis, blood clots, and other side effects. So, really nice to see an oral agent that had efficacy of a biologic and the safety profile of a biologic, which was fairly safe. And really well tolerated by patients. It was also really nice because, as a daily oral treatment once a day, it had the ability to be stopped if needed, and you didn't worry about that sort of long half-life that we see with biologics. So for some patients, that was a little bit more reassuring. They felt like they had a little bit more control over the management, as did some providers. So really kind of changed the way we looked at oral treatments for psoriasis, efficacy and safety, and then also the convenience of dosing, and also the perception of not having to take a biologic that was an injection. The patients are very adverse to that. And some patients also have other comorbidities, such as cancer or surgeries coming forward, where they really both the patient and their other providers were concerned about patients being on biologics that had more of a longer stay in the body that was more concerning.
So, I mean, really, so many pros to this new therapy, honestly. Obviously, there's always going to be a patient that maybe is not a candidate for it. But when you think about all the pros that you just mentioned, you know, even just like the once a day and the compliance, the increase in compliance that you will have with your patients not having to do something twice a day, which the gold standard has been, or industry standard has been, apremilast until now that we have this new option, it was twice a day. And so patients find that hard to keep up with sometimes. And then, of course, when we talk about safety, you had apremilast, and we know there's some GI side effects that can come along with that, nausea, diarrhea, some headaches. And in the pivotal trials, deucravacitinib, patients did a lot better with those tolerability adverse events than those that received apremilast. So, I mean, those are only a few of the pros to this. Jamie, what are some things, if you can think of anything that Lakshi didn't mention, that you have seen in your clinical practice that you have found to be really beneficial with deucravacitinib, and any, you know, patient stories that you might want to share?
I think the most surprising is that, you know, to have patients that had already been on biologic therapy, because we look at biologic therapy as almost like being the standard for clearing patients. And I have a patient, and she has been on deucravacitinib since it was FDA approved because of the fact that I could not get her lower legs cleared. I just couldn't get her lower legs cleared. She had been on several medications. She had started out on methotrexate, been on several biologic therapies and everything. put her on this medication and she has clear legs. To this day, she has clear legs. And you know, when we ask patients, well, what are you hoping? And she said, I want to wear capris. I want to wear a dress. I want to shave my legs. And that's what she wanted. That was really important for her quality of life. And I think for me, that was one thing. So I can't just look at patients that have not been on biologic therapy and not consider this as a very viable therapy for patients. Because as you know, when I really meant it, we cannot look at a cookie cutter approach. And so that's really important. The other thing is that patients too, a lot of patients too with other specialty areas, you know, whether it's hand or foot or scalp, you know, they've really responded great. And so I think that we really, you know, we really need to be open when we're prescribing medications for our patients, as long as it's appropriate, as long as it's an appropriate medication.
And like Lakshi said earlier, it's almost like we have two buckets now. So, can we maintain them on a topical? If not, it's systemic and it's no longer oral, then you go to a biologic. Used to, we didn't have oral options that could give us the efficacy. Well, one, we didn't really have the options, period, but we definitely didn't have them that could give us the efficacy of a biologic. And so now we're kind of having to flip the way that we think of things and not thinking, okay, if they've done a biologic, there's no way I'm going to go backwards and go to an oral therapy, because now we have oral therapies that have the same efficacy as some of the biologics. So, all right, you guys. Well, I think we've hit on everything that we wanted to talk about. Thank you, Lakshi, for joining us and talking to us about some of the novel therapies, talking to us about how you explain the disease process to your patients, and giving me a new way to explain to some of our other colleagues and to patients how to think about how I'm going to put a patient on therapy. So, thank you for joining us. It's always a pleasure to see you. And
Thank you so much for inviting me. This has been so helpful.
oh, you're so welcome. And Jamie, thank you so much. You're my sidekick. And so I don't know what I'm going to do when we don't have any more of these to talk about, but I want to thank you both for chatting with me about this. And for the audience, thank you for joining us. If you liked the content, subscribe to the e-newsletters and you can get some upcoming Medcast episodes and other content get put right into your inbox. So thank you for joining us and we will see you next time.